day, good people, and welcome to episode 7 of the Born Human podcast. Today I am joined by one of the most tenacious people I've ever met, Mr. Wes Johnson Ellis. Wes is one half of Two Dads UK. He is also the co-founder of My Surrogacy Journey, which we will talk about in depth on the podcast. But Wes has had a really interesting journey in parenthood, so it's a real privilege to have him on here today to explore a complicated journey, both in relationship history, sexuality, and being true to yourself and being honest with who you are. Every time I talk to Wes, I feel inspired by his attitude to wanting what he wants in life and not taking no for an answer. So I hope that this conversation fills you with admiration, inspiration, and positivity around what is possible in parenthood and how families can be born out of adversity and challenge. This is absolutely a conversation of our times and so relevant to today's society. And so without further ado, I hope you enjoy this fascinating conversation as much as I did, Mr. Wes Johnson Ellis. So welcome to today's Born Human podcast. Today, I am very fortunate to be joined by someone who's become an increasingly present part of my life, I suppose, through my old business with Kid and Bear and now, or current business, I suppose, that's still going. And now with Born Human, we are lucky to be working together as well. Wes Johnson Ellis. Hi, Wes. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Andy. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on. So Wes is one half of Two Dads UK. I think that's right, isn't it? That's a fair reflection.
I always said a better half, but Michael gives me evil.
Well, he's not here to argue today, so I think that's fair enough. Today, you are definitely the better half. And also founder of My Surrogacy Journey, which is, as Born Human, we're very proud to be working with Wes, Michael, and all the people that are part of that organization to help people build new families. So yes, welcome Wes, and thank you for coming on. Wes and Michael, I think as a couple, have had a long journey. I think that's a fair reflection, and probably quite complicated. And so yeah, give us a bit of background to your family, Wes, and kind of who they are now and your growing family, I suppose. Who are they, and what does it look like for you?
Yeah, perfect. So Michael and I have three children, two of which we had through surrogacy. I have she's nearly 17 and busting to drive, a daughter called Katie from a previous heterosexual marriage. And then we have Tallulah, who we use surrogacy to create our family. So Tallulah is almost 5. And then we have Duke, who's a little boy, and he was 2 last Thursday. So yeah, it's been a roller coaster, but I really wouldn't change it.
Yeah. Well, knowing you guys, I can understand that now. I mean, as I say, it's been complicated, and we'll get into that, I guess, in terms of getting to this point. But it's wonderful to see that, you know, that a family can be born despite all the adversity and challenges that you're kind of presented with in that way. So tell me about your life before Michael then, and kind of when you before you came out as gay and kind of in heterosexual terms, I suppose.
Yes. So when I was in my early adulthood, I kind of, my brother's also gay, and he was openly gay really early, and he's a younger brother, but my parents always wanted grandchildren. And I think when my brother came out as gay, the pressure kind of then shifted over to me. I hadn't come out at that point. Obviously I knew I was gay, but I wanted to, but I don't think I was ready to accept I was gay, or I was ready to tell the world I was gay. And I think, you know, coming out is a very personal thing to everyone, and it always has to be in your time and when you're ready. So for me, my brother coming out meant that there was more pressure piled on me to be, you know, the typical child and produce children for my parents. So, you know, my mum who isn't with us anymore, but she was desperate to be a grandmother and made the most amazing grandmother. So I, you know, started living that heterosexual life. I met who's now my ex-wife, and we got married in Cyprus, and everything was, I thought I could manage being gay, and I thought I could manage it. And, you know, we had Katie, and then it became really apparent that I just couldn't continue to live the life, hiding who you are constantly and trying to manage who you are so people don't recognize some of the characteristics is really tiring and really exhausting and really hard to maintain. So, and I'm just from a mental health point of view as well, you know, for me, you know, I think this is also about you maturing as a person and starting to see the world differently, and actually starting to be more comfortable with who you are. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, when my eldest daughter Katie was one, I decided that I was going to actually make that move and do something that was right for me. So I ended our marriage, I moved out, and I started living a life which was more true to myself, really. And that was as a, you know, as a gay dad to my eldest daughter Katie. And what, you know, what was really interesting is I never came out to Katie, and I just kind of was living my life, and I didn't want my sexuality to dominate my relationship with my daughter. Yeah. So I just kind of got on living my life. And then when Katie was a little bit older, and when I'd met Michael, and we can talk a little bit about how I met Michael in a second, but I remember taking Katie home back to her mum's after I'd spent some time with her and Michael. And I never had the conversation with Katie around my sexuality because I didn't think it was appropriate. But she just turned around and said to me in the car, and the car for us is a place where we have conversations because no one can go anywhere. And if I ever have to have tricky conversations, it's in the car because I've got their attention.
Yeah.
And Katie just turned around to me and said, "Is Michael your boyfriend?" And I remember my feeling my face go red as if to how do I answer. And I just said, "Yes." Yeah. And looked at me and said, "Oh, okay." And then from that point on, it was never an issue. She always knew. So, you know, that for me was one of those things where I never really had to tell her. She just always knew.
Yeah.
But it was never an issue.
Yeah.
And you know, there's as a gay dad, there's always those elements where you have to think about the impact of you on your child and what happens when she goes to school and what happens here and what happens here.
Yeah.
Those are always at the forefront of my mind, but you know, that's just one of the things that extra things that need to really be considered when you're a same sex couple with children.
Yeah. Well, it's an additional component, isn't it? But I think whenever, you know, whenever the stability of a child's home is kind of unsettled, then I guess regardless of whether it's as a result of being gay or just breaking up or kind of whatever it might be, you know, it takes the right kind of attitude to kind of say kids first, because they didn't choose to be in this. We've got, if we're choosing to walk a different path, and we've kind of got to walk that with them in mind and always kind of thinking about them. And it sounds like you did that for a long time, kind of thing, in terms of trying to manage that. How old were you when you knew you were gay? How old do you think you always knew it inside, kind of thing?
Always knew. Really, from a real early age. And, you know, but I've had this conversation with Michael and other friends, and, you know, they always knew, you know, and maybe that's not like that for everyone. But for me, I always knew I was different. I always knew there was something that wasn't the same as other people. And there was always something that didn't allow me to feel how generally everyone else was feeling, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And how was it with, like, with your wife, and kind of, did she feel like she always knew, or was there like a nagging doubt in the back of her mind, kind of thing? Or when you decided to break up, was it a surprise? Or
yeah, so when I ended our relationship, I didn't tell her at that point, because for me, I wasn't ready to make that step. It was, yeah, you know, small steps at a time. And then, you know, the relationship generally wasn't working anyway, and we knew why it wasn't working. But and then at a later stage, I had the conversation with her about it. And you know, she she didn't know. She didn't have any kind of inkling about what I was.
Yeah.
But she after a period of time, she was okay with it, and we still maintain a really good relationship. And that relationship is ultimately about is centered around our daughter and the fact that we co-parent, with Katie. And I'm constantly having conversations with my ex-wife about parenting decisions and what happens here and what happens there. And the last thing was a school prom and a school dress and all of those components. And
yeah.
The next thing is that she wants a car and she wants to learn to drive and she wants to go to a rave.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We're now
I still
having
want to go to a rave. I've got to be honest. I kind of missed that boat. It was just I was too young to get there when it was really going off. And then since then, it all got shut down. Maybe I'll go. We'll all go. Let's all go. Yeah,
well, I might go with her. I don't think she'd like that.
No, I think she probably wouldn't. Yeah, but So I mean, how old was she when you had that conversation about Michael being your boyfriend and kind of. And then it was kind of all out in the open.
Yeah, I think she was about 7.
Okay. Yeah. So really, emotionally aware kind of thing, and actually really grown up for her age, really, at that stage.
Yeah, and I think that for me, when I was a single dad, I always had lots of gay friends, and that wasn't I didn't always have that, but when I actually started living my new life, I found lots of people like me, and
yeah.
And she was always part of that. It was never anything I hid. And, and I think she's a lot more emotionally mature because of the people that I introduced to and the experiences she has, So I was living in central Birmingham. I was, enjoying that gay lifestyle. And, the weekend she'd come and stay with me, she'd come and be part of that. I mean, obviously I wasn't taking her out clubbing and stuff, but, I had a very, big social circle, and that was important to me. And she just became an extended part of that.
Yeah. Well, I think, one thing that really sort of strikes me with is the fact that regardless of what I think that certainly in Britain or with Britishness of, not broaching difficult subjects, and that's still a problem these days. Whenever there's a taboo subject, people are still more comfortable, I think, in general, to kind of bury it than kind of deal with it. When actually, I think for everyone, if you're able to kind of be adult about it, face up to the fact that this may not be conventional, it may not be kind of easy for us to process, but actually the best way through it is to process it and to find a place that works for everyone involved. So really, it probably speaks of her emotional intelligence in terms of, as a parent, it sounds like you took that approach with her, which, and kids learn from that, don't they? They learn to be more emotionally intelligent because you are their peer, effectively. You are their mentor as such.
Yeah, totally. And I think we always had conversations, and I think if there was anything she wanted to understand, then I needed to find an appropriate answer. Because I think I wasn't changing, and I need to equip her with the skills to be able to deal with it. Because, there are going to be times when she then has to explain that, her dad's gay, or her dad has a boyfriend, or her dad's now married. She has to be able to manage that within her own peer group. And it's my job as a parent to give her the skills to be able to deal with it.
Yeah, for sure. And be able to support her through that kind of, the times when she can't quite get the answer or she's not quite sure how to process that, you have a responsibility in that the same way as any parent does, like working through any difficulty for children.
That's it. And I don't think it's necessarily about the fact that I was gay was one component that I needed to equip her with. Kids need equipping with skill sets to teach them and get them ready for life generally. And this was just another one of those components.
Yeah, for sure. So when did you meet Michael then? How did that, was that in Birmingham while you were there or?
It was. So I was living in central Birmingham. I had a place in Birmingham, but I was working on the Olympics in 2012. So
okay.
I had a place in London, and then I was coming back and forth, every other weekend and stuff to see Katie. But this particular weekend, it was Birmingham Pride. And Birmingham Pride is such a celebrated and probably one of the bigger prides in the country.
Yeah.
So I had always had a really amazing time at Pride with my friends. So This particular Pride, it was 2012, and I was out with my friends. We customarily do what we call Pride brunch, so we have a bubbles filled breakfast before Pride. So I'd already had quite a few drinks, and I remember seeing Michael walking into a bar, our eyes connected, and we just kind of started talking, and then we kind of got split up. And then what typically happens at Pride is you have a daytime outfit and then you have an evening outfit, so you go and change. So Michael had left, we'd got split up, and I just, you know, thought that was it. Michael had left to go get changed and was coming back in, and I was going out to get changed, and you have to go through these security lines to get through. Yeah. And bear in mind, there's probably five entrances. There's probably 100,000 people there. And Michael and I decided to connect again through the same entry point coming back in. So at that point, we kind of just kissed, and then the rest, I will say, is history, because we really were very much apart from each other from that point. So, and then after about 6 months, because I was working on the game, so my life was consumed by 2012, but after about 6 months of dating, and after the games, we went on holiday to the Maldives, and Michael proposed to me. And at that point, I think it took me about 20 minutes to answer, and it always gives me jip about that, because it wasn't that I didn't, that I was thinking about it, but for those of you who know me, I'm quite a control freak. So I was just totally taken off guard, and I was just trying to process it. But yeah, I said yes. And we've been married now. It was our anniversary in August the 9th. So we got married in 2014, the year that same-sex marriages were legalized. So here we are today talking to you. Married for 7 years, but been together for nine.
Yeah. And I guess it must be quite a really liberating feeling to feel like you've known who you are for that long, and then to sort of find the person that you completely connect with, and that you're, you know, you want to settle down with in a way that feels like is truly you and authentically kind of who you are. And it must be quite, it must have been quite a euphoric feeling to be like, okay, I've been through marriage once and that didn't feel right, and this totally does. And knowing that, you know, you're able to move forward with life with, you know, cooking with gas kind of thing, knowing that you're kind of moving in the direction that you want to go in.
Yeah, I mean, you said something there which is quite prominent, really, Andy, and we, this is our mantra, and you know, it just felt right. And you know, being in a heterosexual relationship never felt right, but being my true authentic self, and I know people say that all of the time, but it is about, you know, I feel really comfortable. And I think it's also an age thing as well. You know, I think, you know, I'm in my early 40s, and I'm comfortable with who I am. I don't really give a shit what people think. And I, you know, it's just, it is, I'm just being me, and I'm comfortable enough to be able to say that I'm happy with being me, you know. Yeah, there's things I would change, you know, all of those things, but yeah, on generally, you know, I'm in a really good place.
Yeah, and you found who you are, which is great. And so 2012 you got together, 2014 you got married, then what happens with children? When did you decide I'm going to do the maths and work backwards? But it can't have been that much longer.
No. Well, Michael before he met me had been in a long-term relationship for, I think it was about 9 years, with someone who just didn't want children, and Michael desperately did. So that relationship wasn't sustainable and ended before he met me. And then quite early on in our relationship, Michael asked me about, you know, the fact that I already had a daughter was a tick for him. And also that, you know, did I want more children? And if I was really honest, I'd never really thought about it, because I wasn't in a place where I was looking for a relationship. I wasn't looking to settle down. I was just enjoying life.
Yeah.
I was really open to exploring what our options were to, you know, grow our family and for Michael to have a biological child. So those conversations happened really early on. Michael then started looking at what our options were and how we could make our family a reality.
Yeah.
And, you know, for those of you who know us, that's what Michael does. Michael does stuff. And, you know, I'm not naturally that way inclined, but if Michael wants something, then he does all the research to understand what that looks like. And then we started exploring, you know, surrogacy and what the surrogacy options were. Was it UK? Was it international? And, you know, we get asked this a lot around, you know, why didn't we adopt? And the simple answer is we didn't want to. You know, we wanted our own biological children. And, you know, for some people, adoption is an option. And, you know, fair play. You know, there are kids out there who need people to bring them into their family and love and support them. But we wanted our own biological children. So we started looking at how we could make that happen, and which is, you know, really the start of our journey to creating Tallulah.
Yeah.
And later on Duke. So it was neat. But I think one of the challenges is that it wasn't as smooth as you think it's going to be. And it's fraught with challenges, and there's little support, and there's little information to try and tell you what those routes can look like. So, you know, that was some of the main challenges when we started our journey.
Yeah. And so, I completely naively, being heterosexual and never having to go through fertility, fortunately, I was lucky enough to not have to. Like, what was the first step? Was research, by the sound of things, in terms of you working out what your options were?
Yeah, it's go on, sorry.
Yeah, what was it? You know, where did it go from there, kind of thing, and sort of how long is that journey, kind of thing?
Well, Michael started doing research really early on in our relationship. You know, he looked at what the landscape looked like in the UK, and right, really trying to understand the UK. And there's this massive perception around whether actually surrogacy in the UK is legal. Just as a heads up, it is.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that in a bit more detail. But and then Michael looked at international options, and at the time we were looking, you know, India, Mexico, US, Canada, Ukraine, all of those, Cyprus, all of those were options. Some of them aren't options anymore because it's now illegal in those countries. But essentially, it's about trying to understand what's the right option for you. And there are so many different options and so many different ways in which you can create your family. But ultimately, you know, cost plays a massive part of that. And it's all about risk as well. But also, we wanted to feel part of a pregnancy. We wanted to be there. We wanted to go to the scan. We wanted to, you know, be present. Yeah. So for exploring all of those international options, weighing up cost versus reality, and actually wanting to be present, you know, we decided that the UK was the route for us. And I remember being really anti-UK at the start of our journey. And that was primarily because I was really uneducated on surrogacy. And all I saw was risk. And I saw that a surrogate being an international surrogate was less likely to be part of our life and potentially, you know, wanting to keep the baby. So for us, those were some of those risks. And, you know, if I forward to where I am now, that's an absolutely valid assumption and, you know, questions to have at that stage. But those really aren't valid where I am now. So it was really interesting to understand how I thought the journey would progress. But, you know, we started exploring the UK. The UK landscape is complex. The law is prohibitive. The law is designed to prohibit people from doing it, ultimately.
Yeah.
And we just tried to navigate through how we wanted to create our family. Now, Mike and I, as a team, we're quite tenacious. We don't accept no. We kind of, if we see something we want, we'll kind of do what we can to try and achieve it. And that's ultimately how we created our family, with a real lack of support and a real lack of infrastructure in place, really. So, you know, we just got on with it. But I think, and that's my challenge now. And I know we're going to talk about some of the reasons what we've created to help counter that, but it shouldn't be that hard, and it shouldn't be that complex, and it shouldn't be, should be better supported, and there should be help for people who want to understand what their family building options are.
Yeah. And when you first started going through it, if you take yourself back to kind of when you're doing that research and you were thinking about, because my knowledge of surrogacy largely is what I know through my surrogacy journey and working together with you. But the difference for those people listening, the difference between, like, say, the US and the UK is that my understanding of it is in the US, it's a largely a, there's a lot of money involved in that, and there's people making money out of it. There's also people, but they have a different approach to it. Over here, it's much more kind of cloak and dagger, and you kind of have to work, navigate your way through the alleyways to get to where you want to get to. But it's not as expensive in, as such, because you're not, it's not outwardly paid for as such. But
So let me just kind of give you a bit of a whistle stop or a 101 on surrogacy in the UK and the US. So surrogacy in the UK is classed as altruistic. So it means that a surrogate can only claim what's deemed reasonable expenses to be a surrogate for you. And there are two types of surrogates in the UK. So there's a gestational surrogate, which is a one who, which there's no biological link and she carries the baby for you. Or there's what's called a traditional surrogate, where the surrogate uses her eggs, so is biologically linked to the child, and she carries that baby on behalf of the intended parents. Those are the two options. In the US, it's a fully commercial model. So what that means is that there are most states it's legal, some states it's not. All parties will have contracts in place. You would need to find a lawyer, insurance, surrogacy agency, fertility clinic, all of those components. There's a massive variation in price. In the US, you know, it can cost you up to $160,000, whereas surrogacy in the UK, on average, can cost you between $30,000 and $40,000. So there is a massive difference. From a time point of view, if you're looking at surrogacy in the UK, you're probably looking at a wait time of between 1 and 2 years. In the US, depending what state you go, you know, it can be much, much shorter. So those are the typical landscapes. Now, there's a massive perception. Now, surrogacy in the US is, it's, you know, it's very widely well known. It's probably the safest place in the world to do surrogacy because of the infrastructure and the laws in place to protect all parties. Whereas the UK, it is actually legal to do it in the UK, but it has to be done altruistically. No one can profit from surrogacy. And it's often based on trust and friendship in the UK, because the law doesn't recognise those relationships, which is a challenge. But, you know, surrogacy is absolutely legal. And unfortunately, surrogacy in the UK does take a bit of a hit on its reputation, because people, it's unknown. People don't know a lot about it. It's still one of those taboo subjects, really, where people, you know, the first thing they say, well, is the surrogate going to keep the baby? There's lots of kind of, you know, myths and things that people believe about surrogacy. And one of our missions, whether it's through Two Dads or My Surrogacy Journey, is to try and help change people's perceptions of surrogacy. One, to help intended parents more, so that they understand that there are viable options to help them build their family. But secondly, help people become more surrogates. You know, there's a massive shortage in the UK with surrogates. And I think a lot of that is, for some people, being a surrogate just isn't an option, and that's absolutely okay. But for some people, they would love to explore it. They just don't know how to, and they don't know enough about it. So those are the two kind of elements within there. Now, you know, in the UK, the law is very restrictive. So you can't advertise for a surrogate. It's actually a criminal offence to do that. And, you know, there's all sorts of restrictions. But, you know, all being well, the law is currently being reformed. As we, Michael and I, but particularly Michael, have been heavily involved with the law reform, trying to make it more fit for purpose. That law was created in 1985, and families are created very differently now to how they were when that law was put in place. And there's many more routes to creating families. So we just need a law that recognises all of the routes to family creation and gives everyone the protection that is needed to ensure that they can do it as safely as possible.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? To sort of, because the thing that always strikes me is that when you get to a point of as a heterosexual couple, for example, to get to a point of needing surrogacy or wanting surrogacy, then you've probably gone on a pretty long journey at that point already in terms of a fertility journey to realize that that's your last chance saloon almost, or well, one of your last chance saloons. And obviously, as a homosexual couple, a same-sex couple, or even a single intended parent, your journey is marred with an entirely different set of circumstances in some respects, in terms of social acceptance and kind of people kind of supporting you through that journey and being met with barriers that heterosexual couples wouldn't be met with. What were your kind of fears going into it? And did you, or, you know, thoughts and fears before you decided you were going down that road? Like, what did it feel like for you both?
Yeah, and I think what you just said there, you know, perfectly sums up, Andy, you know, that the landscape of the different types of people who use surrogacy. You know, often heterosexual couples have been through a really challenging fertility journey, and, you know, surrogacy is their probably last chance to have a biological child. Whereas same gender couples, they come to a surrogacy knowing that they need assistance. Their mindset is very different, and often it's quite a celebratory mindset, because it's kind of, they've been thinking about it, and actually starting the journey is kind of moves from the thought phase to the actual kind of, you know, it's going to happen and starting to plan it. So that is massively how the landscape is different. But for us, when we started it, I think we weren't thinking too many steps ahead around what the reality of that would be, in terms of two gay dads having children. We were all quite focused on it happening. What stood out for us was that, you know, when we were eventually pregnant and we went to our first scan with our surrogate, her husband, there was me, there was Michael. So we went to into this waiting room, which was just full of predominantly heterosexual, well, all heterosexual people, or single heterosexual people. And the four of us walk in, and, you know, that everyone then kind of stops and looks as if to say, what's going on here then? But, you know, we just got used to it. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, society isn't, it's getting better, but it isn't set up really to recognize this family building creation options, you know, and some people accept it, some people don't, you know, and that's just where we're at, you know. We want to kind of, and that's really why our Two Dads account was created. It was about trying to usualize our family situation and give people more exposure to families like ours, so that what our hope and desire was is that when our children are at an age where they're at school, that people are more accepting and understanding, and actually don't need to ask a question about our family setup, because it doesn't matter. They're seeing it more and more, and it just becomes more of an accepted way. And that's kind of what Two Dads was really set up to do, is really kind of make people aware of that actually we're just parents, you know. We just want to love our children. We want them to grow up, be educated, and be in a safe environment. And just like any other parent, you know, we just happen to be two dads. We don't want to make this big deal of the fact that we're two dads. It's just that we're just two guys who love each other. We've got children, and we want to bring them up in a safe environment, you know, just like anyone else.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? I suppose and I think in some ways there's a blessing, both blessing and a curse, that I feel quite lucky to be living and being a parent and a grown-up essentially in this time of life, where, you know, I think back to being a kid, the amount of prejudices that were around and, you know, are still around. I'm under no illusion, it's not that they've gone, but there's improvements happening, there's things changing, you know. Pride didn't exist back in the 60s and the 70s in the way it does today, because, you know, it wasn't as taken the same way, and the same with Black Lives Matter and all those kind of things. We are growing as a society to recognize each other as human before we kind of look at all these other ancillary things that shouldn't make any difference. You know, we're all entitled to choice. But I think what really inspires me about it is, and what I feel really privileged to be, is bringing up a generation that is going to start a new journey. Essentially, they are, like you were saying earlier, they're going into school, and school is not, no kids at school are going to bat an eyelid about the fact that that their parents are same sex, or, you know, that their skin color is different, or whatever it might be, you know, that they're a Paralympic athlete, or, you know, whatever it might be. Nobody's going to look at those things and think, they're going to be past judgment on it. And I'm sure, you know, I'm not naive enough to think that in my generation it's going to wash out and sort itself out entirely. But I do think this is, I feel quite proud and also quite empowered to be part of a generation that has the capability to change that and to see things for how they should be rather than seeing them for how they were when we grew up, kind of thing.
I totally agree. And it's, you know, it's really comforting to see, you know, Tallulah specifically developing in a way. And, you know, Tallulah is just such an intuitive and smart child, but she also is, you know, I think kids are born inclusive, you know, They're taught not to be inclusive, you know. And when I look at how Tallulah behaves, it's taught behavior, you know. And I think for me, one of the biggest lessons is like from a people understanding about, you know, our families, I don't need to tell same sex families or same sex people about our family. They get it already.
Yeah.
The people, and I'm preaching to the choir. The people we need to be reaching are those who don't understand how our family is made up and why and what and when. And because they're the ones who are teaching their children indifference. And those are the ones that are teaching their children that our family isn't accepted. Because kids are a sponge, they need to be taught. You know, and that's who we're trying to reach out to. We're trying to reach those people who are gonna tell their children that our family setup isn't right.
Yeah. And I suppose, you know, generationally, when we were kids, that message may have been delivered at home. It was likely delivered at school. It probably was reinforced by the kids around them and their peers, right? Whereas the interesting thing and the difference for our kids' generation is that information isn't going to be reinforced everywhere. In fact, this whole sense of like, it's okay to not be okay. And like all these kind of messages that support the idea that actually, you know, no, I'm not going to let that go. I'm not going to stand here and let you as a 14-year-old kid say that it's not okay for, you know, me to have two dads. That is okay. And there'll be plenty of people around them, hopefully, and I'm sure there will be, who'll be kind of supporting that. And in years gone by, it was just like, well, the overwhelming majority very much agrees with the fact that, you know, same-sex couples aren't a thing. Whereas like now, you know, we're shifting the balance, I suppose. The seesaw is moving, isn't it? And it's kind of tipping on the edge.
And if I look back at my own children, you know, if I look back at Katie when she was younger, yes, she was totally accepting, but did she outwardly talk about her gay dad? Probably not, because the environment that she was in didn't allow her to, or give her confidence to be able to do that.
Yeah.
When I look at Tallulah now, Tallulah will stand from the rooftops proudly telling everyone she's got two dads.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, you know. She's not remotely bothered by it, you know. We were away at the weekend and she was on a trampoline and she hurt her knee. I wasn't there, but I could see her from a distance. And she was talking to this other parent, was talking to her, and I think she said, oh, do you want to go? We want me to get your mummy or daddy. So it was like, I have two daddies. You know, and she's you know, she purposely and forcefully will tell people that, you know, she's like, I don't have a mummy. And yeah, she's okay with that, you know. I mean, and that's a whole other thing that people think, you know, we're robbing her of having a mother. But actually, let's take gender out of it. This is about parents, you know.
Yeah.
For me is the key thing. It doesn't necessarily have to be a mum, a dad, two dads, two mums, one mum, one dad. It's about people and it's about parents, and that's what they need. They don't need all of those things. We give our children everything that they need.
Yeah.
You know? And our kids have grandmothers, they have aunties, they have female influences in their life. They have an elder sister, Katie. You know, they're getting everything that they need.
Yeah, and I think actually it's like no childhood is perfect in terms of what is brought to it. We're all left with issues from our childhood, and actually as parents, the conscious choice we can make is to be attuned to what those challenges might be for them. And actually, if you're ignorant of kind of the fact that, you know, they might not have female presence in their life, then that, yeah, sure, that might be a problem if you're just surrounding them with men. But, you know, if you're a conscious parent, then actually you present them with love in the first instance, and that's largely what, oh, love, food and water, and probably a bit of sleep somewhere in there as well. But aside from that, you're, you know, as long as we're conscious beings and we're kind of looking at how we making our kids balanced, in the same way as it is for me, right? Like I'm part of a heterosexual couple and my family are all heterosexual, but we live in a society where everyone isn't heterosexual. Now I could choose to kind of not introduce my kids to gay people. That would be weird for me, but it would also be limiting for them, right? And it's exactly the same on the other side of like, well, if you don't expose them to everything, then how are they ever going to learn? And you know, no one's naively who wants to be a parent and wants to love their children isn't going to give them those kind of influences, right? You're going to introduce them to women and kind of having those kind of female role models in their life to kind of learn from.
No, totally. And it's a, you know, the key word is balance. You know, it balances everything, you know, making sure that they get what they need so they feel safe, they're able to strive and flourish in their environments. And, you know, I don't want my kids to be worrying about stuff that I, because of my sexuality, you know, I want my kids just to be kids, enjoying life and doing everything that they need to do, you know, and ultimately I just see people as parents. You know, one of the biggest, this is something we haven't driven into Tallulah, but you know, she at school, she is the most inclusive little girl I know, because at school she won't ask people if they've got a mummy or a daddy. She just says, where's your parents? Because that's the environment that she's in. You know, we don't have these stereotypical labels for everyone. It's like they're just parents, you know, and also they might, you know, might be carers, parents. You know, it's there's so many different, you know, roles out there for children, and we have to acknowledge all of them. You know, not everyone has parents, not everyone has a mum or a dad. You know, and I think by using language that's more neutral and that doesn't make people feel excluded is really important.
Yeah, well, totally. I mean, even, you know, in generations past, adoption has been a big thing for has been a thing for a long time, right? And yet I imagine being adopted has been a really challenging thing in terms of you're always seen as on the outside, whereas actually if you're inclusive in terms of who are your parents, who looks after you kind of thing, then actually you kind of bring people back into the fold, right? And you say, it doesn't matter to people that love you and people that care for you. They're the ones that are kind of raising you and bringing you up. And actually you're welcome. You're welcome in our society, just like anyone else, you know. It's I'm interested to sort of go back to call this. I don't really know what you call this, but it's interesting for me to sort of understand and to share with listeners kind of thing, how it was for you guys when Tallulah was born and kind of going through the pregnancy and, with your surrogate kind of thing. Were you both there at the birth? Were you, how did that kind of function and what did that feel like for you both when she arrived?
Yeah, so Tallulah's pregnancy, the pregnancy of Tallulah with our surrogate Caroline was really straightforward. We got pregnant really quickly on our first attempt, and the pregnancy, you know, motored on through. We attended every scan. We attended every appointment. Now, our surrogate was based up in Burnley and we're based in the Midlands, so it was quite a trek. We had some challenges before Tallulah was born around the trust where our surrogate was due to give birth. They'd only done maybe one surrogacy journey previously, very little education, just really dealing with the policy of what the law says. So when we went to have our first meeting around birth planning, we were just faced with all of the stuff we couldn't do. And I remember coming out of the session with Michael saying, again, this just doesn't feel right. We're just not going to accept this. So we decided that we were going to formally complain to the trust, because, you know, there's some things that they were talking to us about, like, you know, we had to hand the baby over in the car park, not on hospital premises. We couldn't have our, you know, our baby's wristband on. Everything that we were asking for, it was no, 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 no. And we're like, this just doesn't feel right. You know, we didn't want Mariah singing White Lilies, a unicorn trotting through the ward. We just wanted the same experience as everyone else. And the problem and some of the challenges is that, maternity services in hospitals are all set up and designed around women, and we don't want to change that because ultimately women give and they need that security, that support around them at a really sensitive time. But we just needed to have an environment which took into account the journey we were on and helped facilitate us meeting our child and being part of that process. So, we went back and forth and it just wasn't really going anywhere. So we had to get a lawyer involved and we sued our hospital trust because what actually it turned out was that there were 14 counts of discrimination to us. And it wasn't that they were intending to do it. They weren't going out of their way to discriminate against us. But unfortunately, their policy, which obviously wasn't fit for purpose, was just not really where it needed to be. So, yes, we weren't trying to get any financial gain out of them. We just wanted them to change their policy to allow us to be part of that, be present at the birth and do, one of the big things for us was that we wanted the wristband that Tallulah, when she was born, that goes on her wrist, to have our name on it.
Yeah.
Because for us, it was a really important thing because this would be the first thing that would ever have her name on. And for us, that was a really big thing.
Yeah.
And all I kept hearing from the hospital, the system doesn't allow that. It doesn't do this. It doesn't do that. So we had to compromise on it. And they gave us a wristband with Tallulah's name on it. But just going back to just pre-birth then. So we did manage to get everything sorted out with the trust and everything was put in place. We had amazing midwife who worked with us, a lady called Caroline Broom. And we got this, our birthing plan all in place, which is what we all wanted to do. And then one evening at 2 a.m., we got the call to say that our surrogate's water had broken and that we needed to move.
Yeah.
Bear in mind, we were a 2-hour drive away. So, and Katie was having a sleepover that weekend. So Katie and her friend was there, like 2 a.m. I had to frantically get my dad round to come and stay and watch the kids. So we obviously had bags packed and everything ready. So we shot off. But then we were in like trackies and I had a cap on. We were driving and then like 2 a.m. in the morning. So we had this police car following us. But like, it felt like an eternity, but they were following us for a good 10 minutes. So I had to do the speed limit and I just wanted to put my foot down. But the last thing I wanted was to be stopped. So yeah. We were like, we did look suspect, but then as soon as they stopped following us on the motorway, down the M6, and we made it just before they were starting to give her an epidural because our surrogate wanted an elective C-section.
Yeah.
And we were happy with that. And part of the birthing plan was that we would be sat in a side room so that she would be in the theatre with her husband. We'd be in the side room. As soon as baby was born, husband would bring it through and then we would meet our baby in the side room, which was all going lovely and to plan. So Caroline went into theatre and then we were just like waiting and waiting. And then her husband, Dave, came into the room with no baby. And we were like, what's going on? He was like, quick, get some scrubs on, you go into theatre. So we quickly got the most unattractive scrubs on. And what had happened is Caroline, our surrogate, had asked the theatre staff if we could be there.
Oh, how amazing.
We hadn't planned for that. And we weren't emotionally or psychologically ready for that. But
yeah.
What happened is we went into theatre, we saw someone being born. It was an amazing experience. And, the overwhelming thing out of that is that we worked hard with our trust. We worked together and we created a birthing plan, which was amazing. And they were amazing. They gave amazing care to us. They gave amazing care to our surrogate. And, it was such a positive birthing experience, but because we put the work in. And, and so then, Tallulah was born and changed our life forever. So
yeah.
That's kind of where of our journey to with Tallulah, and we left that same day. Just like we wanted to, balloons, baby carrier, and had a really lovely experience, and then the fun started. But Tallulah was a model baby and always has been. But
yeah.
And then if we fast forward to we then after a couple of years decided that we always knew we wanted another child. Tallulah is biologically linked to Michael. Created embryos using my sperm for our second child. We did an embryo transfer and it failed and we lost all of our embryos. So we decided to kind of take a break from it because it's quite consuming. We also decided to move clinics. But also what happened in the meantime was that the egg donor that we used for Tallulah, who we plan to use again for our second child, wasn't able to donate again. She got sick and couldn't donate. So we had to find another egg donor. And we found a friend. So a lady called Francesca, who's a good friend of ours. She is a fertility nurse and works in a fertility clinic. And she said, I'll give you my eggs. So we did. And we created more embryos in a different clinic in London. We did a transfer, which was successful first time. And then, so we used the same surrogate again, Caroline. She wanted us to complete our family, which is just such an amazing gift from, it's such a selfless act. And, you know, I think people underestimate the gift of being a surrogate and what they go through to allow you to have a family. And then Duke's pregnancy was slightly more challenging, because Caroline was older, you know, and we did a planned C-section. We went through the whole birthing plan again. We had the same midwife, same team. Everything was so much smoother. But we agreed early on that we'd be in theatre and they allowed us to be in theatre. So we saw Duke being born. Again, another amazing experience. And I think one of the big things for me, one of the big learnings is, you know, seeing your child brought into world is such an amazing thing and shouldn't be missed. I mean, I get that some people, they don't have a choice and they do miss it. But if you do have a choice, I would recommend anyone to be there and be part of that experience.
So both mine were born by C-section. First one was emergency and then planned second time round. And you said something a minute ago that was like, it went much smoother the second time round. And it's sort of, I kind of empathized with that in as far as like the first time was chaos and the second time wasn't. But what the one thing that really stuck out for me in both situations was like, when do you ever get a chance to sit in theater like awake? Like the only time you ever go to theater is when you're knocked out, right? So it's quite surreal. You kind of, I don't know about you, but I kind of felt like I was in ER or, you know, house or something like that. Kind of just sat next to my wife at the time, still my wife. My wife kind of like, this is bizarre. Like you're pumping drugs into her and you're kind of like, and there's a curtain and it's like, do you want to come around past the curtain? And it's like, I don't know. I don't feel like I should be here, but I'm really happy I am here. But it's quite a lot to process almost afterwards, right?
Like, and you know, the thing is like, you know, we went at the head end. I don't know how Michael does it because like Michael watches something on TV and he's nearly collapsing just at the sight of blood. So to see someone literally be cut open and go in for the child. I mean, I was quite interested in seeing it, but Michael was like, I had to hold on to him tight. I think the adrenaline had kicked in at that point. And, you know, the thought of, and also with Tallulah, we didn't know what we were having at that point. With Duke, we did, but with Tallulah, we didn't know. And Michael was convinced that we were having a boy. And then when he realised it was a girl, I think it was a lot more emotional as well on that basis. I think, you know, the adrenaline had definitely kicked in because we just weren't. And also for our second for Duke, because we knew it was an elective C-section, we knew we were going in. We were much more nervous then because we'd had time to think about it. Whereas with Tallulah, we didn't have the chance to think about it. It was like it was happening there, and come then in. We just
yeah. Don't you want to come in or not? Like now's the time, kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's crazy, but it's like one of having children is one of life's miracles, right? Like it's the, you know, one of the few things that we get any influence over pretty much. Is I appreciate that with surrogacy and fertility and that we are able to kind of make a difference, but ultimately, like, you know, Mother Nature still rules the roost, right? She chooses what happens almost. And you know, and it is that sort of sense of like it's a life experience that you can't get any other way. And I certainly after Wilbur was born was kind of like I had some processing to do, just to sort of make some, I mean, it had been quite traumatic for Lucy, for both of us, but she was doing the hard work. I'm not even going to fight that one. You know, so it was really quite traumatic. And, you know, and then you don't get the time to kind of deal with it until afterwards. So you kind of come to it. You're so busy kind of being a parent at that point that like 6 to 9 months afterwards, you're like, actually, I wasn't comfortable with being the wrong side of the curtain. But it's like, this was like 9, 12 months ago now. I didn't realize that at the time, but it's all sort of split decisions and making those quick choices, right?
Yeah, totally. And I think one of the things for us that, you know, we didn't really consider, and we only look back on it and recognize it now retrospectively, was the fact that with the same gender, you know, two guys doing surrogacy, you know, only one of us can be biologically linked to a child.
Mm.
And then there's the whole, those that aren't biologically linked, how do they process that? How do they deal with that? And how do they, and what, how does it manifest itself? You know, for us, when Tallulah was born, I kind of kept it all in my head. I was going through all of this stress about, will I bond? Will she bond with me? What do I need to do to bond? So I was really sensitive about wording. So when Michael said, "Oh, pass me my baby," I was like, "It's not just your baby, it's my baby too." And, you know, yeah. So there's all of those things to consider with surrogacy, and particularly if you're using donor eggs or sperm. It's like, it's making sure that you recognize the fact that this is going to happen, what that's going to look like, how it's going to manifest itself, but also be able to talk about it, because and the same thing happened with Duke. But we didn't talk about it, you know. Yeah. We only talked about it when we'd had both of our children and we realized the impact it had. And it's about being able to recognize it and put the processes in place to be able to help each other deal with it. But also about the other person being sensitive and yeah. recognizing that this is happening and helping to alleviate some of those triggers and stresses that happen. What is generally a really stressful time anyway.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the things that, you know, I'm really grateful to be working with you on as part of my surrogacy journey, is that, you know, my passion is in mental health and in parental mental health and kind of, you know, mental health in general. But like, when I think about kind of all my friends that have been through kind of either fertility journeys or trauma and loss, and it's essentially nobody escapes it, right? As a parent, if you're wanting to be a parent or you are a parent, nobody escapes it in one way, form or another. But what really sticks out for me, and what I learned from having a son to our daughter, was that actually the planning that we did to help us be better mentally prepared for what we were dealing with, and the opportunity we had to really learn from the things that frightened us the first time around and the things that we had control over or didn't have control over, what I learned was that they shouldn't be things to be frightened of, even though they will be at some degree. What they should be is things that you're able to cope with and you've thought about. And it sticks out for me as like, before we got married, we did marriage mentoring. So it was like six weeks of, they were kind of evenings. So it was once a week, we'd sit down in the evening and we'd have with a couple from the local church, and they basically sit down with you and you spend 2 or 3 hours chewing the fat over all sorts of subjects. And that might be around children. It might be around your thoughts on money, on, you know, illness, all sorts of different subjects. But what it forces you to do in that period is kind of think about what you're actually walking into. And not to suggest that nobody's going into it for love, doesn't take away from that, but it does give you the opportunity to kind of explore. Luckily, we'd had, you know, nothing came up for us that we'd sort of felt, oh, we haven't really had that conversation. But like, money's, you know, as an example, is a really big deal for a lot of couples. You know, it's like a thing. And, you know, there are lots of different components that affect people, and often people don't have the conversation about them. And I think this is exactly that. And one of the reasons I'm so excited to be working with you guys for my surrogacy journey is that the journey that people who go through surrogacy have been on are many and varied, complex, challenging. And in that 9 months before a baby arrives, they have a window of opportunity to really explore the things that might come up, and for somebody to kind of reflect into that space and say, well, let's have a conversation about that. What will it feel like knowing that biologically it's your son, but not your son? How will you handle that as a couple? What will that mean for, you know, your relationship with grandparents and all those kind of things, you know? Because actually, let's hope that none of those become an issue. But if you have a conversation about it and say, no, I'm okay with it, I think, at least you've thought about it.
Yeah. And I think it's about preparing, and preparedness is really important, because I think the better prepared you are when these things happen, you've already thought about them. You're not then having to think about them right there and then when in a situation which is stressful.
Yeah.
If you prepare for them, and this happened, and for me, this is about, you know, you as a couple, your support network, everyone around you, it's about preparing them as well, because the more you can do to prepare them for what's happening, the more they can process it in advance and be hopefully in a better place, you know, from a mental point of view, of gone through all of those thoughts, had time to ask those questions, work out what it means to them. If they don't understand it, ask more questions. So that actually, when you get to the point of where, you know, this is happening, all of that stuff has happened, and it's evoked conversations and discussions have been had, and potentially mechanisms have been put in place. One of the big things that I say, Michael gets, he just rolls his eyes every time I say it, but you know, you don't know what you don't know, particularly on a journey like this. This is, yes, this is a well-trodden path, but not for everyone. You know, there are people, and often what we found is that, you know, surrogacy just doesn't affect the people going through it. You know, remember, you've got your set of intended parents to consider, you've got your surrogate to consider, your surrogate's partner, husband, wife, family, children. There's so many different people in the mix. And then outside of what, you know, your team working towards creating a family, you've then got the wider group of people. You've got, you know, support network, friends, family, you've got healthcare professionals. There's so many people that ripple out from that one team of people that need to kind of understand what's coming, how's it going to affect me, what does that look like. And I think working with, you know, Born Human to help people understand what's coming, that's a really important thing. And you know, like I said earlier, if you're in a stressful situation and then something happens, you're not going to deal with it in the same way that if you were dealing with it outside of a stressful environment and you've got time to process and understand and accept what's happening.
Yeah, it's so true. And it's, you know, ultimately it's just forward thinking, and it all kind of connects really when you think back to the conversations you were having about your relationship with Katie and kind of planning in that relationship, and you know, planning it as a couple in terms of what surrogacy looks like, doing your research. It all comes down to knowing what you're letting yourself in for, being honest about how you're feeling, sharing that, and finding the right help at the right time to be able to navigate it right. And I think, I guess that, you know, quite neatly, I'm conscious of time, but the you know, that brings you onto your fourth baby of my surrogacy journey, and that is a fourth baby really, in terms of the amount of time and effort you're putting into it, I think.
It absolutely is, and it's much harder work than any of my children, I can tell you that. But you know, so you know, thanks for that introduction, Andy. But what typically happened was, you know, when Michael and I finished both of our journeys, I say we finished them, we're still on them with our children, but when we actually got to the point of having our children, we looked back on reflection and we just kind of thought, you know, there's very little support, there's very little information, there's very little infrastructure around to help people understand what their family building options are and what that can look like. And two, once they decide that, you know, as an example, surrogacy is their journey for them, what does that journey look like and how do they achieve it? You know, what is the route and how do you navigate it safely and almost, you know, how do you enjoy that journey? So, you know, we in lockdown, we'd been thinking about creating an organisation which supported people better with much more tailored support, the more professional support rather than, you know, just people's opinion or peer-to-peer. And we created this non-for-profit organisation which is primarily designed to support, but, you know, intended parents, surrogates and known egg donors on their journey to helping create their family. And it's about, you know, it's a membership-based organisation, and intended parents can buy a membership, which ultimately guides them through their journey, gives them an 8-stage roadmap and it's designed to support them right at the start of their journey when they're trying to understand what that route looks like, all the way through to the point of, you know, they're pregnant, they're being prepared to be a parent, because let's be honest, no one prepares you to be a parent. You know, it's hard going. And, you know, so we wanted people to be prepared to be a parent. And then once you're born, give you the support that you need to help you enjoy those first 2-3 weeks, and have an infrastructure around you to give you all the support of everything we didn't get. So ultimately, that's why we created My Surrogacy Journey. And it's really important for us to, we want to do something different. We want to make sure that we're changing the landscape. The surrogacy landscape has stayed the same for the last 10 years. No one's doing anything innovative. No one's doing anything to help support people. And that's really why My Surrogacy Journey came to life, through lived experience and the lack of support that we got. And for us, you know, working with partners who can add more benefits, such as Born Human, to our members. But also, you know, we have a clinical team, people who can give, you know, clinical advice to people rather than just giving people. You know, often people get anecdotal advice or they get peer-to-peer. Well, actually, that's not professional. And it's, we want to make sure that people are given accurate information that allows them to make the best informed decision for them on how to create their family.
Well, I think it's amazing. And I think it's, it's having sort of had this conversation and seen the journey that you've been on and how sort of complicated and how challenging it can be and all the ups and downs, then I think it's, I guess, quite fitting really that it should result in something great. And and I think there are plenty of couples that will benefit from it. And I feel privileged to be a part of that. So thank you for having us as part of it and sort of making that change.
You're very welcome. I do remember having conversations with you right at the start of our journey. And I think you've been, you know, kind of sat in the wings watching it all develop over the last 6 months, and it has just gone mental. But you know, the thing for me is that we're helping people. And, you know, I have some really challenging conversations with some intended parents who've been through some really, you know, horrific loss and, you know, a really challenging fertility journey to get them to the point where surrogacy needs to be their option. And I just want to fix and help everyone, and I can't. But, you know, there's just such a need for people to help other people. And if, you know, we can do more and more to help people understand how being a surrogate is more possible, which in turn helps people, you know, create their family, which they've tried so hard to get, then I'm happy.
Yeah, totally. Oh, I mean, I echo that from my point of view. It's great to be a part of changing people's lives. I mean, that's the whole point of Born Human in exactly the same way. It's like, I don't want this to happen to other people. I want to see us making smarter decisions to be better educated and to, you know, help navigate some of the bits that we can predict, you know. With that in mind, Wes, it's been really lovely to chat to you. But what, for all that you've been through and all your experience, what one piece of advice would you give to other people on similar journeys in whichever stage that is for them? What one piece of advice would you give to people?
Never, ever give up. Don't give up. Find the right people, find the people who can help you, understand what that looks like for you, and just don't give up.
Well, that's a nice point to end it, I think. And actually, if anybody is listening to this and is at that point of wanting to find out if Michael and Wes did give up, I imagine if they look at Two Dads UK or My Surrogacy Journey, they'll realise that it does pay off to not give up, I guess. But thank you very much for your time. It's been really great to chat to you. And we'll hopefully be speaking more often over the next 6 months as we find some babies on the way, with any luck.
You will, and we might already have a baby on the way.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. That's amazing. Oh, you heard it here first. Although this probably won't be going out live, so the baby might actually, you know, be with us by then. Who knows? But yeah. Oh, exciting. That's wonderful news. Congratulations.
Thank you for having me, Andy. It's been amazing to chat to you.
Pleasure. Thanks for coming on. Take care.
That's it for this week's Born Human podcast. A massive thank you to Wes for his honesty and for joining us this week to share his journey. I know the emotional roller coaster that Wes and Michael have been through to having their family as it is today has been insane, and I take my hat off to them for the amount of sheer persistence and commitment that they've given to it to make it a reality. And for Wes specifically, having to go through that transition from being in a heterosexual relationship to being in a same-sex relationship, and all that navigated around his daughter and how he got to that point. I have so much respect for everything they've done, and now everything they're doing for other families in similar situations who are also struggling with their own challenges. So I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. I genuinely, every time I speak to Wes, it's nothing but inspirational. And so I'm very grateful to have had him on today. And to all of you, thank you very much for listening as ever. It really is amazing for us to have all the feedback we've had from you all, and all the love that we've seen for the conversations we've had so far. So we're now halfway through this series almost. So please do like, subscribe, share, do all of that good stuff, because it really gets us to a place where people can hear our stories and share those journeys. So thank you very much, and we'll see you next time on the Born Human Podcast.